Hello, it's been a bit, and this isn't going to be a really long one. I don't have a lot prepared, but I did want to give a little bit of an update and provide some food for thought for folks. I think I've mentioned in the previous video that I've been exploring the content around Carl Friston's free energy principle, and I think some people may think of free energy as something that has to do with actual energy, but what it's actually a way of being in the world and consciousness. And the consciousness stuff is really what I've been focused on lately. And Friston's idea of the free energy principle is essentially that we hold a model of the world in our head. And as we take in information, we're comparing against the model that we have. And if it's surprising information, then we either are faced with a choice of sampling a different set of information that reconfirms the model that we already hold, or shifting our model into something else, tweaking it. And then there's an energy expenditure associated with that. So that's not done regularly. And it's almost like a thermodynamic equation. We might imagine that our brain is constantly reacting to the senses that are out there, but from what I understand, the energy cost of that is exorbitant, and our brain would like fry if we were constantly like waiting for in the moment to get the sensory information and reacting. And so we're constantly prediction, like we're prediction engines. And I think Yosha Bock, he was talking about it with Michael Levin, that we were maybe not, it's not even prediction, but it's coherence engines. So consciousness holding a coherent story. And I think we have to think about that in the context of living in an age of information, digital, massive amounts of digital information that we're swimming through all the time. And so we almost have this extra sense now. You know, we have our regular five senses and maybe have, our psychic sense, but then we have this information sense and we're being bombarded with so much, and we're sort of sifting through, swimming through the information and throwing this out and looking here and looking there. And a lot of times sociologists want to talk about, navigating information spaces like confirmation bias, or it gets wrapped up in conspiracy theory or different, they want to put different labels on it. But ultimately, we're confronted with information. We have to sort through it. We have to make sense of it. We have to fit it into our story. We have to adapt our stories and move on. And I'd really like for people to sit with that idea for a little bit, because to me, at least with navigating my family situation, it's helped me understand how things settled out, that there was the story that I'm currently navigating is based on a ton of information that most regular people would never have occasion to dig into, because it's not going to be on NPR. Maybe 10 years from now it'll be on NPR, like once they've normalized it. It's not going to be, it's things that you're talking with your colleagues at the water cooler at work or with your at the dinner table. These are not typical things. Yesterday I tried to, the electrician came to swap out a couple of fixtures, and I'm like, "Hey, do you know about optogenetics?" And of course the electrician doesn't know about optogenetics and like light-based frequency neuromodulation. But we all should, like, it should be something, that we should be talking about. It should be on 60 Minutes and NPR and these things that we are having ethical debates about using the built environment to be interfaces with our biology and tweak us somehow. But we don't. And so I have sort of a voracious curiosity, and I'm always glomming onto all this information and sorting it out. And my maps are really like mind palaces and representations of how the stories that I've been compiling and thinking about. And I would say if these, what's interesting to me is like I'll get new information and it'll finally click back to things that I was researching 10 years ago and like, and shed a whole new level of depth and light on these topics, including what works government and government regulation and how that relates to the protocol layer and Web3 and token engineering and socio-technical cyber-physical systems. So just think about like world building, story building, information theory. Think about the rise of influencer culture and videos in the lockdowns. Think about how the video culture and the online media culture interfaced with the social media and the feeds and the sort of group mind and group think and digital community, and what that kind of what how meaningful those digital communities actually are, and how that's all trackable and predictable and steerable. And really thinking too about like the emotionality of it, because a lot of the stuff, it's very split second. I mean, most people, I don't know, you know, I might have 3-hour videos and most people are going to watch maybe 10 minutes of the video or something like that. You know, maybe there'll be a long medium piece and people read the first chunk, and then it, you know, not often, but there's sometimes you're in conversation with someone and you realize like they didn't actually read it or they didn't actually listen to it because they say something that's patently contradictory to what you actually said in a projection. And so we're just navigating because it's like a deluge. I mean, we're human beings. We're really not meant, calibrated to take in all of this information. And then, so rather than to be like taking less and be really thoughtful about it, we take in more. And what do they ask us to do? Is like, react, do this, do that. And then there's this feedback loop within a lot of the online communities that like amplify. And a lot of it is, in my opinion, looking back in retrospect, it's self-traumatization, which isn't terribly helpful. So like there's a lot of the quote unquote resistance that clearly we were all traumatized by policies that happened, but then we have perpetuated for years self-trauma loops and bonding, trauma-based bonding that really, I think, is not serving us very well. So the reason what kind of provoked me to talk about this today is I've been looking through the channel, the Active Inference Institute. So the Active Inference Institute works closely with Carl Friston, and they also interface with Mike Levin and the work on morphogenetic fields, and thinking about that again with the protocol layer and social physics and things like Will Ruddick and grassroots economics and Cello and Charles Eisenstein and the sacred economy and how all of these systems are coordinating us as the superorganism, you know, as Josiah Over would say, like this Athenian city-state as a superorganism. And this morning, I'm working on a quilt. I'm having a good time with that. And I'm listening to some videos. And this one was with a guy. His name is John Boyk, I think. John, and Boyk is B-O-I-K. And he was speaking with the Active Inference folks about something called Cognar, and it's about cognition and narrative, and essentially it was an open source software system to support group decision making, but it's really about the superorganism, and they wanted to be able to scale it anything from like a small group of 5 or 6 people to millions of people. And it's interesting because Boyk's background is actually in biomedical engineering and cancer engineering, and he was with the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. And he's based in Houston. And again, you know, I need to get back with Lynn on the OER stuff, but I think this very much relates to the Houston schools takeover and, you know, Rice University being there with the nanotechnology and the space medicine and the NASA in Houston and the inner space and these explorations of group dynamics within using quantum biology to access the field. And so Boyk's background up until really around 2008, 2009, which is where the social impact stuff jumped off, was very much medical focused. And there was stuff about nanophotonics, and there was stuff about like plant-based bioreactive nutrient things. And so, you know, just, and then it quickly pivoted into community currency and direct democracy and these other topics that were around group decision making. So how do you go from doing like nanophotonics and cancer research into participatory democracy within an organism, like complex organism? And so this cognitive Cognar system was supposed to sort of facilitate that through structured storytelling with AI. And to me, this brought to mind on my descent map, and I can insert a picture of that, but that was all about direct democracy. And one of these was a future of a welfare state where you would get a UBI, but part of that would be that you would tell your trauma story into the system. And I thought, oh my God, like, can you imagine? Like, we've got all this training data and we're training AI on like horror and trauma. And it didn't quite make sense to me why you would, and it wasn't, you were supposed to tell it to peers and then they were supposed to react. And I, at the time, I didn't have this piece of the puzzle about the free energy principle, which was originally theorized in the 90s. So it's been around for quite some time, to mesh with that and the emotionality of the story. And I have a friend who's a professor in education, and this friend has been telling me about the emphasis on autoethnography in academia, that there's very little, like in the social sciences, there's less and less deep research-based inquiries. This person had a background in statistics, social statistics. It's much less about that, and it's more just like, tell me how you feel, right? And then, so we have that, and then we have this UBI based on storytelling, often traumatic storytelling. And then we've got these AI systems that are going to be doing group decision making, like almost AI facilitated story structures that are supposed to facilitate cognition. So Sean, I've been working on consciousness a lot, and I know, again, what story are you in? How much of the resistance is still caught up in the same story, watching the same influencers that they were 4 years ago? Like, how many new things are there? Or are there things that are being introduced as new that maybe Steffers and I were talking about at the very beginning, the first year, and now all of a sudden, 3 years later, they're being talked about? Like, that's information management, right? That's, what's his face? Josiah Ober's friend. It'll come to me. But he's the guy who is working on knowledge management and Bitcoin. So yeah, we're not supposed to know that until down the road. That's programmed for 2 years later, 5 years later. So I'm working in consciousness. Also, Sean had given me this book, or he didn't give me the book, but he gave me the name of the book. It's Janet Murray, Hamlet in the Holodeck, The Future of Narrative in Cyberspace. And she was at MIT for many years, and then she... This is 1997, okay? 1997 here. So oldie. She was at MIT and then later on moved on to Georgia Tech. And so she's talking about immersive storytelling, hypermedia, virtual reality, gaming environments, exploratory, not just swordplay, but thinking environments, and these labyrinths that can be layered and nested of different storylines. So this was all being planned. And again, Akildiz is at Georgia Tech with all of the nanotech. And so my inclination is, if you look at the clip that I shared with Mike Levin about polycomputing, is that the future of computing is somehow going to involve our embodied and a collective intelligence, distributed, so far-flung, and again, information theory, we're spread out all over the globe. This is this noosphere. And that through movement, through emotion, we will be processing information that maybe we are not aware of on the back end. And it will be done through storytelling, interactive storytelling, which if you look up Elaine Rayburn, R-A-Y-B-O-U-R-N, she's at Sandia National Labs. She also works with the military in simulation modeling on transmedia learning in the military. Again, framed as like, oh, we just need to simulate cultural exchange to navigate military engagements. But it's really much, much more than that. And that transmedia learning is going to be baked into the education space through the Open Education Resources, OER, and the XAPI, the Tin Can API technology that's going to be pulling all the data off of all the wearables and the sensors. Yeah, and Sandia National Labs is the Department of Energy. So, and I think that this connects into psychodrama, which is Jacob Moreno, and he did early work in sociograms. His son, Jonathan, is a professor of bioethics at Penn. And... Yeah, I think the future of computing is psychodrama. And I think it may also interface with the Gurdjieff aspects. And again, Margaret Naumberg and Montessori education. And so group movement and dance and eurythmy and panurythmy may be information processing in the field that is happening through our biology, our quantum biology, and our embodied intelligence through our microbiome that lives on our skin and in our gut and is in us and on us, is that it's a collective computing process. And that's going to be happening through the protocol layer, right? And so I had shared a clip a couple days ago from Sean had also introduced me to David Krakauer, who's I didn't realize is the president of Santa Fe Institute. And so thank you, Sean, for that. And there's a David Krakauer who's a klezmer clarinetist, which is not that one, it's the other one. But there's an interesting interface in the digital twin of klezmer and clarinets and complex systems in music, in my mind. So if you look up David Krakauer, find he was an evolutionary biologist and very much interested in complex systems. He has the Santa Fe Institute. I've listened to a lot of his talks over the past week while I was making my quilt. And there was another one, it was not featuring David, but colleagues at the Santa Fe Institute, and it was about regulatory systems. And again, I would say thinking about the protocol layer and socio-technical systems, cyber-physical systems being regulated, having key performance indicators, and smart cities. They were mentioning this regulation, performance, and efficacy of regulation in the context of smart cities.
Can you describe some of your research on scaling in human organizations? Who did you work with? How does it fit in with Heijin's work on cities?
So a large group of us at SFI, Heijin Yoon, Jeffrey West, Sid Redner, Vicky Young, who's now at MIT, and a whole bunch of really wonderful postdocs spread across those institutions, trying to understand what we call the laws of regulation. And so this is one way to think about scaling in human organizations, but also scaling in different types of organisms. What we're really after is why you see across the tree of life, from bacteria to large organizations, some investment in regulatory function. Why do organisms spend resources, whether that's energy or money or time, regulating other functions? We often bemoan this as bureaucracy, and many people would say useless bureaucracy. But why do we spend so much effort and resources on having some amount of overhead regulatory function? So we're trying to write down very general theories for that. We're looking at lots of interesting data that span bacteria to cities to human organizations, and just understanding how the amount of regulatory function changes with the size and complexity of a system and whether that's optimal or not. Our argument, in part, is you see lots of regulation in bacteria. Bacteria have an enormous capacity to refine their function. They have huge population sizes, and because of that, they can see really small changes in fitness. And so many people have argued that if something is irrelevant in bacteria, it gets selected out by evolution quite quickly. And so if a bacterium has a lot of regulatory genes, those really are doing something useful. That is not a relevant bureaucracy. That is something fundamental to those cells. So we're trying to take what we understand from bacteria and then scale it up to lots of different systems to just ask questions about what optimum regulation looks like.
And to me, the way they were talking about it, and it's a short clip, maybe 2.5-3 minutes. It's very much in the vein of quorum sensing in bacterial colonies. And I really do believe that what we're dealing with is this eusocial insect approach. And someone had given me this book a while back. I haven't actually read it, but Honeybee Democracy, Thomas Sealing, quoting E.O. Wilson. Yeah, the hive mind. And that turning cities into cognitive cities, but not simply cognition in the material sense, but also psychic. And actually one of the J.G. Bennett, who was working in the UK and was a student of Gurdjieff, he was interested in the idea of like psychokinetic communities. And to me, this idea of these communities that have a biological component, a spiritual component, a psychic component that are harnessed as a group unit. And that fits with things like, you know, Jamie Wheel's, the ethical cults. And so there's another synchronicity, and I think this is the last book I'll show, but a friend that I met here, this is her son, and he wrote a memoir called Special Ed, My Dystopian Dyslexic Success. It's by Mark Farnsworth. And Mark made a career as a self-taught computer programmer, but he had a lot of learning issues. And his family, for about 10 years, was involved in a psychological experiment called Synanon. And Synanon supposedly was sort of fronted by this guy who was in AA, but what Mark had done through extensive research is to find out that it actually seems to have been an extension of a human ecology project on group psychology that was, you know, human ecology connects in with MK Ultra, and was actually affiliated with very prominent psychologists, including Abraham Maslow, who we know that Maslow was also connected with Julia Stolman and Irvin Laszlo and the Foundation for Integrated Education. And this, essentially, it was a cult. It was, it had a number of campuses. The main campus was actually in Marin County, California. And it was, no kidding, the main building was a lodge built by Marconi for wireless telegraphy, right? So they've reconverted the Marconi, and there were wires all over connecting the lodge, and they shaved the heads. And then, again, in the youth social colony mindset, they shaved the kids, they gave everyone uniforms, and they separated the children from the parents and put them in dorms, and then they broke up marriages and reassigned partners among the parents, and there was a caste system. And part of what was the centerpiece of this cult was something called attack therapy, where they would bring people in and scream at them. And initially it was an addiction treatment model, which brings to mind the San Patrignano plans that Bobby has in the background there for all of the youth. But then eventually it also expanded into people who were more interested in sort of a communitarian utopic lifestyle. So, and there are a number of spinoffs because, again, if this wasn't really just this guy Charles, who was the former alcoholic, it was really the government. It never really went away. I think at one point they claimed they organized as a church to get around the IRS, and there was some litigation, and the folks there put a rattlesnake in the mailbox of the litigating lawyer who was harmed. And eventually, I think it sort of shuttered in the 90s, but it had a spinoff called CEDU, C-E-D-U, that was one of the early originators of the troubled teen institutionalizations, and that was really many horrific abuses documented there. And so the interesting thing about Synanon, if you're thinking the San Patrignano and what all I've said about the abuses there, and the fact that the founder of San Patrignano, the founding director, was a psychic faith healer, an abuse murdering psychic faith healer, that there was there was this Netflix documentary exposing San Patrignano. But again, it was kind of like a pre-bunk, right? We're going to tell some of the story, but we're not going to tell all of the story. So we're going to be familiar. So when it comes up, you're just going to be like, oh yeah, that was that Netflix series, right? And so there was evidently an HBO documentary on Synanon done this spring by that was produced or directed by Rory Kennedy. So Bobby Kennedy's youngest sister. So imagine that. And, you know, I can just see the family reunion getting together after the election when Bobby is appointed, you know, Make America Healthy Czar in charge of the expansion of rural troubled teen centers for organic farming and permaculture. And just to, it's gross, you know, it's like another pre-bunking attempt. But to me, this was really important. And, you know, there was someone that I was connected with, Quantum Heart Cafe, and she was doing a lot of research into tokens in institutional settings. And again, this token economy was something that was used initially in preschools, prisons, and mental institutions. And so, again, these were in communities where people would maybe be identified as not civilized, right? Preschoolers haven't yet been converted into civilization fully, right? Prisoners are people who are non-conforming to the understanding of proper society, and the same with people with mental illness. So with the tokens, if you imagine what maybe in some sort of biohybrid polycomputing is trying to get into the field, you've got this deep Skinner box history of token economies going back to the 60s and 70s in this. And you know, and again, what was interesting to me about Mark's book was that he was dyslexic. And so, of course, many of the impacts connected the cost offsets for social impact bonds in education that are bringing in all the technology are linked to the special education costs. So, you know, I wanted to bring these things up. I will put a link to the John Boyk talk. For me, it was really helpful because it got me thinking about, again, going back to Bloomberg, Michael Bloomberg, the data-driven what works government, you know, and I can see that in a new light, this idea of the superorganism as a decision maker, the idea of humans embedded in an environment where the environment also has some aspect of panpsychism, right? Some aspect of life in that it is interacting. It is acting as an extension of your body. You know, I had that talk at one point with Cliff. We were talking about the outside-in robot, right? The outside your house or your church or your classroom or your office. I guess they're going to close down all the offices eventually and just turn those into dorms. And think about, like, again, closed office buildings and WeWork and Flow as a hive environment, right? With forced socialization and tokens. And again, this guy Boyk was working in nanophotonics. So yeah, we're moving kind of towards a synthetic telepathy or a managed telepathy with stigmergic signaling. So these are all the things that are on my mind, and they feel like they're coming to pass. Oh, actually, so Louis Yablonsky was part of Synanon, was doing research there, and he studied under Jacob Moreno, who was the psychodrama sociogram guy. And again, sociograms were connections of nodes of, like, influencer culture, very old school, like just drawn dots of, like, a classroom of preschoolers and who was connected to who and what the social interactions were. And think about, again, Sepp Kamvar and his sidekick Charles Eisenstein and the Montessori school and the sensing technology. To me, it's all enmeshed with Gurdjieff and quantum biology and movement and drama and gaming and relationality. And they're telling us it's going to be about solving problems related to sustainability or anti-poverty. This guy Boyk is all about the anti-poverty stuff. But they're not telling the whole story. And maybe they don't know the whole story. And the more I understand the free energy principle and active inference, if you're an expert, you've got a deep, deep groove in a certain story because you're the expert. You've spent considerable intellectual resources, economic resources, social resources into learning a particular story in detail. I'm a generalist, so I create these maps and they're all linked all over. Trying to tell folks about, and eventually I'll go back to the Santa Barbara map and the Big Heart Intelligence and Julian Gresser and his community blockchain health program, because it's everything that Bobby is setting up. But I have tentacular thinking. And so I'm pulling all these things together. But then, of course, the active inference people would say, well, those things aren't really connected. You're just doing apophenia. These things aren't connected. But who says they're not? Because in their story, they're not. But in my story, they are. And then whose story can you measure as the more authentic story? And then again, and how stories change and flow. And David Krakauer, he was talking a lot about contagion and spread of contagion, but I think beyond viral contagion really is a mental virus contagion. And, you know, I'm just kind of coming to terms with the fact that I don't have a very popular story. Fortunately, at this point in time, I'm not trying to make a living off of sharing the story and getting people engaged in the story. I'm just trying to sort this out for myself. But I was never really in the resistance movement, like maybe for a minute there, right? And then within the first 6 months, I could see many things that were inconsistent and didn't add up. And in retrospect, it makes a lot of sense exactly where things are going. And I would assume, rather than saying those are bad people, many, many of those entities, individuals, influencers, they weren't ever going to be able to hear what I had to say because it didn't fit in their story. It just bounced off. It's just like kryptonite. But it's still lonely. I mean, there was another person that I had known while I was online who has a channel and was articulating this sense of being different, right? Being and grappling with that being different. And again, how to be in this world while being very different. And even, you know, at this point, I don't know, outlier of outlier of outlier. Like, I'm kind of in a story, and this guy Boyk would say, oh, well, that's not cognitively functional, you know, that I'm not, whatever I'm, the story that I'm engaged with isn't enhancing my status or my stability or economic stability or what have you, community connectedness. It's sort of like you have to set aside a huge chunk of information you know in order to be functioning in society. And then, you know, I did leave a comment. I said in some times in the past, there were communities that would value people with a different perspective and what they offered into the community because that was something that was worthwhile. But in some ways, we're in a very divergent and highly conformist. So many divergent stories, but within each story, highly conformist, right? Like, how many people out there were telling me, Allison, you're doing it wrong. You know, you're doing resistance wrong. It looks like this, you know, you're messing up the story. We need numbers. Don't, be distract people with these things over here. And from everything that I can see, you know, in the research that, you know, we were doing, all, you know, all of these folks over time, it is happening. It's just, I guess what I've realized is that when it happens, it's going to happen wrapped in a story that allows people to integrate that as something that's okay. And maybe it is okay. I, you know, at this point, I'm trying to be less judgmental, although it's difficult because I did have someone come into the comments on this clip about regulatory environments, right? And for me, if you've been listening and integrating, not just listening, because I think that's the feed does this. It rewards superficial listening and then forgetting. Like you listen to something and then you forget it. And you listen to it again and forget it. And so it's just always like whatever is at the top of the feed is what you're paying attention to. You're not like listening and then integrating it into your story because there's a cost to that. There's an energy cost to that of comparing it against what you know and what you don't know and how you feel about it and then taking in parts or jettisoning parts. It's simply like there's very little integration happening. It's simply like consume, react, consume. And then everyone's like, because it's not good to be that way. We're not built for this. We're not built for this information physics. And so what I really would want would be for people to come onto that clip and say, oh, wow, I can see how this relates to behavioral token economics in my kids' classroom. Or I could see now that they're going to do UBI with digital wallets and that, oh, and they're going to mesh the democracy reforms that the populists are going to bring out with this sensing, like with these tokens. So, right? And it goes with the protocol labs, only what they were working on it with the refugees, like Leo was talking about, and Cello. Like there's so much information that we've laid out. And yet literally the best people can summon, it seems like, is just to react and be like, don't like, angry, don't like. And at this point, like, the don't like angry isn't going to actually change anything. Didn't change anything for 4 years, really. Like, they're running the game. The gaming scenario is rolling out. Yeah, we're reacting online and we're signaling and so that they can get ahead and group, you know, steer the herd and give them the story that they need. But this comment, it was a reactive comment, and it just says, there was some presumption that I agreed that whatever this game was totalitarian. And I would say we need to be very careful about the words that we use because they are viruses and they're structured. So I remember in, you know, 2016 on the liberal side, they had everyone and still again running around screaming about the fascism, Trump and fascism, Trump and fascism, Trump. Well, there was stuff going on. It was way more complicated than this reductive term, right? Now they've got all the resistance. It's totalitarianism. How many people used that word before it was given to them in the feed? Not much. I'm just betting you weren't running around on a weekly basis tossing in totalitarian in your conversation. It was injected into your consciousness. And then you chose to pick it up because when you pick it up, then you're part of the community that's worried about totalitarianism. And I just said, we have different views of what this thing is. We understand this game differently. And they're like, yeah, but yeah, totalitarian. I'm like, no, we don't have that in common. I do not see this as totalitarian. Because if you understand it as totalitarian, you're going to be doing the waggle dance with Bobby. You're going to be participating in my understanding, and I'm open to being wrong. I'm not saying I'm right, but all of my research, and I would hazard a guess, I do way more primary research than most people who are spending all their time reading other people's stuff. I'm researching it, and it says, no, this game is participatory. This game is participatory because it's using the postmodern brain and consciousness. We are the biocomputers. We are the heart-based biocomputers, spiritual heart-based biocomputers. So all of this stuff with like the alt-health movement and the biofield people and the ascension people and the democracy innovation people and the conservative, like it's all going to the same place, which is using some sort of nanophotonic light system for collective decision making through emotional, spiritual engagement with one another for some purpose we don't understand. And I want to presume that at the back end there's some benevolent force, maybe with a slight sense of humor, who's like, oh yeah, like, what are the odds that one of the first lovely people I meet has this really fascinating life story that totally melds with everything that's going on with my research? Yeah, that's maybe God having a little bit of a like, ha-ha, you know? I have to believe that there's a meaning that we're going through what we're going through. But it's participatory. And so if you think it's being done to you, you're not going to be prepared for the invitation to be part of the AND computer. You're just not. And I guess maybe what I have to realize is just be okay with that. I don't have to save it. I'm not here to save anybody. I can't save you. I can't really even save myself because, again, I'm like with this active inference, I've written a story that certainly is going to be no Netflix extravaganza. Nobody wants to be in my story. Very few people want to be in my story. It's complicated and it's difficult. And it's not, it doesn't lend itself to extended emotionality. It's something that's odd. But I built it, so this is where I am now. And maybe I'll go build another story later. But the participatory nature versus totalitarian. I want you to think about it, because if you actually imagine that you want to understand the game and participate in it as a informed player, you will integrate this understanding into your assessment. And because, yes, they know enough about you from the Substacks, from the YouTubes, from everything to offer you an invitation that you will find very attractive. So, yeah. So I'll put the link to John Boyk's talk on Cognar, which links storytelling from a biomedical photonic plant bioreactive nutrition thing. And if you don't see a lot of like the whole Austin Joe Rogan freedom cell stuff in that, like, I can't tell you, you know, it's all in there. Texas, there's a lot going on in Texas. Check it out. So anyway, thanks for listening. And I'm doing well. It's cooled off here. I'm playing in my yard. I'm weeding. I'm gonna get a big load of mulch and mulch a bunch of stuff, and I'm quilting, and I'm gonna have a friend over and bake some bread, and we're gonna have some dinner. So, yeah, all in all, in the postmodern brain, we're navigating it. Morpho space. All right. Talk to you later.